Everybody's got a guy.
Well, I know a guy too.
Actually, two guys. I got Sal and his brother Ben. And I drive 2 hours from Northwest Indiana all the way to Nordica and Addison on the northwest side of the city, passing all the other butcher shops to get to Joseph's Finest Meats. Why? Because I grew up in a butcher shop. I know what quality is. I know what attention to detail is. That's Joseph's Finest Meats, 7101 West Addison Street in Chicago. Homemade sausages. Oh, yeah. USDA prime-aged beef and butchers who know what they're doing. Do me a favor. Do yourself a favor. Go to Joseph's Finest Meats, get some Italian sausage, and you'll never want to go anywhere else. And it's the only thing that Betty will make when she's making peppers and sausage. She wants Joseph's. And that's an endorsement based not on anything other than the quality of their work. Because my name means something to me, and their name means something to them. Joseph's Finest Meats, 7101 West Addison Street in Chicago. A family tradition since 1977. A proud sponsor of John Cass News and the Chicago Way Podcast. There's a lot of celebration and emotion in our country this time of year. We look at our founding fathers. We think about the wild pigs and how to catch them. And they caught them. And we're talking about the founding fathers. And did they really mean to do what they did? The Declaration of Independence is the greatest document that this great republic has produced. Why is that? It starts with God. And it also deals with individual liberty and the primacy of the individual, freedom, liberty, and the American way, because that's what it is. Now, there's other people who are not happy. They're not proud to be Americans, but you know what? I am, and Jeff Carlin is, and Charles Lipson understands it and is proud. And Charles Lipson is our guest today. He's the Peter B. Ritzma Chair, Professor Emeritus of the University of Chicago. And anyone listening would like to have Charles Lipson as a professor to sit in his class and discuss American history and the cultural changes. And Jeff Carlin is here, as always, loyal, steadfast, and true. Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, friend of cats, baker of pies, future physics teacher. And for me, John Cass, editor-in-chief of John Cass News, where you always get a good cup of common sense. Just $50 a year, 2 columns a week, and the podcast, plus extra podcasts and extra columns from David Bittinger to Jimmy Benakis to Dan Proft. So many. I think it's worth it. And where are you as smoke settles on the big, beautiful bill and the violence of Chicago and Los Angeles and New York continue, driving the people home afraid of being on the street corner where the rough boys take out their guns and the politicians gaslight you and tell you that crime is down and don't worry about it. You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way, that's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
So as promised, to talk about all this, is none other than Charles Lipson, our good friend, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, writer of many things, writer of many books, many articles, And one of them is the scale of Xi Jinping's humiliation is now only becoming clear. Only now are the full effects of the 12-day war becoming clear. Israel and the U.S. have fundamentally reshaped the world order. Charles, tell us about this piece.
Well, the piece tries to go beyond all the immediate questions about how much of Iran's nuclear material was actually destroyed in the amazing bombing run by the B-2 bombers, the stealth bombers, and beyond what Israel managed to destroy in what Trump, who has a flair for naming everything, big, beautiful bill, 12-day war, all the rest, and of course his nicknames for his political opponents. But I wanted to ask, what was the influence across the Middle East, not just on Israel, but across the Middle East, and then on Russia and China? And I think the influences are, the impact is quite large, actually.
So tell us about that. What are the impacts on China?
Well, the issue with China, there's some internal issues that are unrelated to the war. And I think Xi Jinping is in deep, deep trouble. And it looks like he may have lost control of the military. And indeed, he may have lost power in general. We just don't know. He didn't go to the meeting, to this big meeting of the so-called BRIC countries with Russia and Brazil and so forth. He didn't leave the country for that. And that's unusual. But his main goal has been to take Taiwan in as part of China. That's a complex and difficult task because the most complex military task of all is an amphibious invasion. Mm-hmm. And look at D-Day, how difficult it was, which we celebrated a month ago, the 1944 invasion on June the 6th. But that was a short trip across across the English Channel. This is 100 miles across the Taiwan Straits. It's much more difficult. And the key issue there is not only Taiwan's ability to defend against that, but the American deterrence. Can America deter, not just defeat China, but deter it in the first place? And what you saw was that Trump, at least, showed that he was willing to use American military power and use it in a decisive way, and that adds to American deterrence. So that combined with China's internal economic problems and Xi Jinping's weakness, the military leaders outside of Xi Jinping don't seem enthused about the idea of an invasion. They may not say we're going to abandon it, but they're not enthused about it because they know how dangerous it would be. So that's a big deal. And the other big deal is Russia. And Russia, mm-hmm. I mean, this is outside the Middle East itself. Sure. Russia not only lost a powerful ally in Iran, which was supplying it with all of these drones that were hitting into Ukraine. Russia has the ability to build those drones itself, but it was getting a lot from Iran, which shows you that how weak Russia had become. But also, Russia has been trying for decades to build a large presence in the Middle East, and it had two areas where it was doing that. One was Iran and the other was Syria. Well, Syria has experienced a revolution or a coup d'etat, and they lost Syria, and they lost essentially a base on the Mediterranean that was in Syria, mm-hmm. and then they've lost Iran. And when the war occurred, the 12-day war, when that occurred, Russia and China, neither one of them came to the aid of Iran. So that's going to weaken them as an ally around the world. And they didn't come to the aid because they could see it would be useless that America and Israel together were very powerful. And the maybe the final point, and we can look at the implications of this, is that Israel is now the strong horse in the whole region.
Mm-hmm.
So that has big implications.
You even saw it too. There was a story reporting earlier this past week as we taped this that the a minister from China was talking about how now China's focused on Ukraine. They can't handle another loss like this as far as supporting the loser. They can't have Russia be a three-time loser when it comes to all their endeavors, and why would they be involved? Do you think that ends up pushing the needle further for them to help Russia achieve whatever the goals are in Ukraine?
It's a great question. I actually think that it will make China more reticent. China has not had a high profile in Ukraine up till now. They've offered Russia some military aid, but at a kind of low level. And I can assure you that if China does offer them anything more, they will want something in return. What they've been getting in return has been oil and gas.
Yeah.
They've been getting it despite various sanctions on Russia. I think the big question now on Ukraine is whether Trump will offer more aid to the Ukrainians. There's a split among conservatives. Among the MAGA types, they don't want any more going to Ukraine. But there are a lot of people, not only Democrats, who think that it's a good idea for Ukraine to continue fighting Russia, but that if Russia takes Ukraine or takes more of Ukraine, it poses a greater threat and a costly one to all of Europe. I'm not sure how much that is so, because Russia has just been absolutely drained by this war. But if Russia could be defeated there, it would be a major blow to Russia, even if Ukraine didn't retake a lot of territory. And the only way for that to happen is for a lot of arms to come in. The ideal thing would be for Europe to pay for those arms, but the arms themselves would come either from Ukraine itself or from the United States. I would just say the thing we're learning militarily about this war is how important drones are. We used to say that tanks were the queen of the battlefield, or maybe the king, but tanks are really vulnerable to cheap drones. The drones say where the tanks are because they can survey everything, and then these kamikaze drones can do a lot to take out the tanks, and have taken out most of the Russian tanks. The more advanced Western tanks have jamming devices and other things that help against the drones. But that's what we've learned militarily, is a changing shape of the battlefield. What we're learning, I think, and this has not been picked up, I think, very much by analysts, is that America's three great opponents, Russia, Iran, and China, have all now have very vulnerable regimes. The fact that the West has been defeating them has left their political systems in chaos. And that's a very big deal. It's really hard to know when a regime will fall.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't break like a tree where you can see the tree bending and bending, and at some point you know that the trunk will break. It breaks more like glass, where you put more and more weight on a glass tabletop, and at some point, all of a sudden, it just cracks. But China looks like it's in trouble. I don't think that the regime will collapse, but it's certainly possible there'll be a change of leadership. Putin's regime is in real trouble, and in Iran, you see them now trying to take away everybody's cell phone.
Yeah.
And you see them cracking down. And I wrote recently that it was, in a way, it was too bad that Trump called off not America's war, but Israel's war before it had done more to weaken the IRGC and the internal suppression mechanisms in Iran, because unlike Syria, where the regime fell within like 2 weeks unexpectedly because there was an outside military force that came in, there doesn't look to be a well-armed and well-organized opposition in Iran. I mean, there's opposition, but not well-organized and well-armed. So we just don't know if the regime can kill off enough people, which they're trying to do, to suppress a revolt.
Yeah, I'm going to double back real quick. Mm-hmm. You talked about how that, you know, the West collectively has seemingly been had the upper hand in all these little incursions throughout the mm-hmm. throughout the world. And then, you know, there's this instability in the regimes of places like Russia and China and Iran. Mm-hmm. From like a sociological perspective, why do you think that is? I mean, my gut is it's a repressed people, and oppressed people, you know, are more likely to speak behind closed doors and not follow orders, or maybe not do what they should be. But why do you think we're there? What's the difference there? What's our upper hand?
Well, the Chinese people have been repressed for decades. I mean, millions, tens of millions were killed under Mao. So repression is important, but they have to be able to see some alternative. And it's very risky to try to go after the regime. And normally what happens when these regimes fall is there's a crack within the regime itself. That people who lead the regime, some take one side, some take another. That's not always the case. The Assad regime in Syria seemed to have been solid until it was overthrown. But part of the weakness of these regimes is that when you think about a solid regime like the United States, we think about our military. It's only designed to deal with external threats. But if you've got a regime like China or Russia or Iran, mm-hmm. they face an internal threat as well as an external one. And the more they focus on the internal threat, the weaker they are in dealing with an external threat. And what happened in the Iran war in particular is both the internal and the external mechanisms were severely degraded. In China, the People's Liberation Army is mostly focused on the external threat, but they've been able to do a lot of internal repression. Their problem now is that they have tried to legitimate the regime, at least in part, on economic growth, but that's really failing now in China. And it's also failed in Russia, and of course it's failed in Iran. But in China, after Deng Xiaoping, what Deng Xiaoping learned from the fall of the Soviet Union was that you can't do internal liberalization at the same time that you do economic liberalization. Gorbachev tried to do both, right?
Paris, the Shah of Iran tried to do that too. And
right, what happened to him. Right. But right. What the Chinese did was they decided, okay, we can liberalize our economy, but we can keep tight political control on any dissent. And we saw that firsthand Tiananmen Square, at Tiananmen right. Square. Yeah. That's right. But
and also during the COVID epidemic that they created and spread to us, right. They were repressing their people with, remember right. I think anecdotal doesn't work, but that one anecdote about the drones that were circling, flying over the high rises, telling people to stay in their homes. Remember that?
Right.
Well, they were even worse. They were sealing people into their apartments. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. Right.
And then burying people secretly in large mass graves.
Right.
So while they were exporting this thing with the help of an American, Fauci and all the others who were saying, don't believe your lying eyes.
So what is happening now on the ground in China as a result?
They have time. One of the things that we've learned about large economies is you can't manage them from the top down.
Right.
You can tweak things. This is not a libertarian argument. I mean, we need highways, we need police forces, and so forth. But the Chinese decided that they would put a lot of effort into various sectors of the economy, such as automobiles, electric automobiles, and those have all kind of failed. They built a lot of housing, and there's now that failed a couple of years ago. They were building apartment building after apartment building, and there are these vast areas where there are empty high rises. It's like the commercial buildings in the South Loop. You know, yeah. They're never going to be occupied. And but this is, of course, much, much, much worse. And that was designed not only to house people who were coming into cities, but also to give work to construction workers and so forth. And then when that failed, they turned to building these electric vehicles. And now there's nobody to drive them, and there's nobody to buy them, and they've been their batteries are kind of older than the new generation and so forth, and they're just piling up.
They have nuclear weapons. So,
they're a big power. Don't get me wrong.
So what do we have to do? What's the wise case scenario? Is it we keep them viable so they don't collapse and lash out and destroy the world?
It's an interesting question. What we know is that the policy that was pursued since Bill Clinton, which was help make them rich by letting them join the WTO, the World Trade Organization. They will get rich. And as countries get richer, they become more democratic. And as they become more democratic, they become...
That was the belief.
It was a belief. And we now know that failed. They became richer.
So did McConnell, right? Mitch McConnell and the rest of them.
Yeah. They became richer, but they didn't become more democratic, and they didn't become friendlier. They became a more dangerous adversary.
Right.
Now, what will happen to China now? And I would say Russia is hurt by drill, baby, drill, because the only thing they have to sell is oil, and they need a high price for it. China is helped by lower oil prices because they're an importer, even if they can't import from us. But I think that the issue that is still quite uncertain is under Trump, the U.S. will treat trade policy with China as if it was the Soviet Union, where we want nothing to do with trading with them. We'd like to weaken them. Our lesson from Clinton would be don't make them richer, but that would also put strain on them. Or whether we'll behave like Europe did with respect to the Soviet Union and then later Russia, which is we'd like to buy cheap oil from them. We'd like to buy this and that. We're not going to put any strain on our economy, and we don't care what the Americans do, and we'll just trade with them. So I don't know in this dealing with China, but what you're seeing, and you'll see a lot more after July the 9th, which is when all these higher tariffs begin to kick in, if there's no trade deal. Mm-hmm. What Trump is doing is different with China than he's doing with any other country. We know he wants to strike trade deals with Korea and the European Union and every India and all the rest. Okay, but we don't know that he wants to do that with China. But what was really interesting in this recent trade deal with Vietnam is not only that it left a 20% tariff on everything from Vietnam, but that it put a 40% tariff on things that passed through Vietnam. Well, what were they where were they passing through from? China. So what you're going to see in all of these deals, Philippines, all the other, Thailand, if any of these other deals are going to say China cannot transship through you without very high tariffs, and we're going to keep an eye on that. So we're squeezing China really hard. The question is, and for Lipson at least, it's unresolved, does Trump really want to get cheap clothing and other things from China without giving them high technology? Or does he just want to put the strain on them economically and thus militarily?
Before we continue on this, I want to say two things. One is, we are speaking with Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, of the Ritzma Chair, and you can find all his stuff at charleslipson.com. And I recommend that website because it's full of Charles Lipson's wisdom, and he puts things in context.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
Well, it's true, Charles. And let me put this in context because of what we're talking about. Some of you may know that or may have heard that the President of the United States has a new chairman of the National Intelligence Council, and that is my brother, Nicholas. And we do not speak about anything involving the United States. Really, he's been there 2 weeks. I don't think we had any substance.
It's like the first rule of Fight Club, John.
What is that?
You don't talk about Fight Club.
You don't talk about Fight Club. You don't talk about anything. But with my brother, and that's
different. But congratulations on Nicholas's very prominent position.
Well, I just want people to know, some people don't, unfortunately, it's part of the human condition that we jump to conclusions. And I do not have any discussions with my brother, who is an anti-deep stater, and he's proven that in commentary and columns he's written for me and for the American Conservative and for the National Interest. He is not a friend of the deep state, but that's all I know going forward here.
Let me say, John, related to that the news that's out today is that the president wants to to change the intelligence networks in ways that are really important, because he thinks that they've kind of grown like topsy and that they're a bit out of control. And so I'm sure that what they're doing at the National Intelligence Council and elsewhere will be part of this larger effort, which is a very important effort. And we saw that recently when the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, leaked a report on the early damage assessment, which was leaked clearly to undermine the Trump administration. It was leak of highly classified material to publications in a way that was designed to undermine. It's a different question whether the analysis was correct or not. The point is, it should never have been leaked, and the reform that your brother will be part of, and clearly was appointed to be part of, this is just an inference on my part, but it is very important for the security of all of us.
And we see that there was a new report just a few days ago, a CIA review of the Obama administration's handling of the spy agencies, and it's damning.
Yeah, and the key figure there was Brennan, John Brennan, and his the statute of limitation for any of his liability. The important point here was that the intelligence agencies were if these reports are accurate, the intelligence agencies were an integral part of the Russian collusion hoax, and the Russian collusion hoax was ginned up by the Democrats, by Hillary Clinton.
And Obama.
And Obama, who was president, to prevent the election of Trump. Well, the reason we have an FBI separate from the CIA is that the CIA is not supposed to do anything domestically.
Yeah.
And the worst thing they could do would be to interfere with a U.S. presidential election. And we need to know if it happened. And we shouldn't allow the statute of limitations to run out on any potential court cases for people who were at the heart of that.
Unfortunately, they have allowed this to happen because through the Obama administration, Biden and so forth, and the Congress has to change the law if they want a different outcome, but they don't, because I don't think they want a different outcome right now. I think if they change the law and put teeth in it, then it would be used as political.
What law are you talking about, John?
Well, the law about allowing the statute of limitations to expire on key issues like national security, like the CIA review of the Obama administration spy agencies that interfered in the 2016 presidential election.
You know, it's an interesting question because you see this a related issue coming up with Joe Biden's dementia.
Yes.
Which is the Trump administration has so much to do going forward. And that in some ways, it seems like a diversion to look backwards. And that's the major argument that the Democrats are making. They're not stressing, oh, Joe Biden was completely on top of everything. Yeah, they can't defend that. They're not even defending the Russian hoax. They're just saying, well, America has problems. Let's look forward. Rural hospitals. You know, that's their answer to whether there was interference in the 2020 election or Joe Biden's cognitive problems is let's look forward. That's all true. But if there was deep, really deep corruption here, and both of these are really deep issues, if they can be proven, if they really happened, that there was intelligence agencies trying to affect a U.S. election, and worse, if they actually did.
We're screwed.
And if we had a president who couldn't make key decisions on laws and executive orders, and other people were doing it without the president's total cognitive understanding, then these are about as serious as you can get in terms of a democracy.
Well, that's what I think personally, that's why I think Biden was so attractive to Jim Clyburn and Obama and the rest of the deep state, because sure. They had what I vulgarly refer to often as a meat puppet. And I'm sorry to even put that phrase in the same paragraph of the president of the United States, but they had their meat puppet in order to do what they wanted to do. Bring in 25 million illegals across the border, and there's no question that had an impact on our culture and our politics
and on our census.
Yeah, well, that I said, John, you could probably move away from even the meat puppet thing. Is that is as this is predates his senility, that you know, it's been well documented that Joe Biden has gotten rich and his family has gotten rich as during his time in Congress. And everybody knew supposedly that what he was doing, back dealing, making trade deals, doing things to help his family. And so they had the goods on him. So he had to do what everybody would tell him to do. Oh yeah, he's going to be our guy. We got him controlled because we've got him by the short hairs. So now it's, let's use him. I think the senality thing was unexpected. And now it's become this weird, you know, like you said, this Soylent Green sort of world.
They had another reason as well. Both of these are great points. That he was at their disposal for various reasons. But I think there was another point, which was that the alternative was Bernie Sanders.
Right.
Yeah.
And the problem wasn't, I think, that they thought Bernie Sanders had the wrong policies, because so many of the policies that that Biden actually pursued were very similar to what Bernie would have pursued, or Elizabeth Warren. By the way, yeah. We don't know why Elizabeth Warren stayed in for one more election. In Massachusetts, one more primary election that really prevented Bernie from winning there and staying in the race. That I would like to know. But what we do know is that the Democrats, beginning with Clyburn, were very fearful that if Bernie was at the top of the ticket, they would lose the House and the Senate. And so they had a reason, aside from control of the White House, who was in the White House, to get Bernie Sanders out of there. He wasn't a regular Democrat. Indeed, he caucused with the Democrats, but he's not a Democrat. He calls himself a Democratic Socialist. And the rise of Democratic Socialism in the country is now just tearing apart the Democratic Party. But on foreign policy, which is what we've been focusing on here, it's totally unclear what a left wing of the Democratic Party would do, because on Ukraine, liberal Democrats have actually supported arming Ukraine in a way that more conservative Republicans have often not supported it. So they've been more willing. But what Bernie Sanders and his crew want to do is they want to fund only domestic programs, especially entitlement programs. And the only pot of money that they can get at is military. And that's why the military readiness declined so much under Obama and then later under Biden, and why recruitment to the military has surged under Trump. One of the most striking things in recent polling to me has been the party split on "Are you proud of America?" And the numbers for Republicans are like traditional American numbers. You know, almost everybody's proud of America.
Well, even according to the poll you're referencing, during the Obama years, the Republican Party was like 90% proud of being an American. And during those years, like as Michelle said, this was the time when she was finally proud of America. The Democrats were also somewhat proud. But then now, Charles, what do you make of these numbers? Where
they're catastrophic. And they're catastrophic for the country. Now, what I would say is that I would like, I haven't seen the number. These are numbers for 2025. And I haven't seen the numbers for 2024 when Biden was still in office. Because what I'd like to know, we're talking about less than a third, right, of, I don't have the numbers in front of me right now. What are the numbers for Democrats that you saw?
Let me see. 30.
Yeah, I've got it here. So, you're right. So this is the Gallup poll, and a record low, 58% of U.S. adults are extremely or very proud. So that's 41% extremely, 17% across the board. So this is not being broken down by partisanship. Mm-hmm. But then when you look it down to break it down to Democrats and Republicans, 92% are extremely proud, very proud, moderately proud, or just a little proud. So that's, again, almost all of them. And if you look at Democrats, and this is 2025, 36% fall into that category.
Right, all essentially one third. And
it's revolutionary.
But here's
and real quick, Charles, before you get to it, it looks like, because Gallup does have a trend line across the last 5 years on this. And if you were looking roughly at 2024, it looks to be around 60% was the number. So it's cut around in half in the last year.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting, because you see, some of not proud could be, I'm not proud that Trump is our president if you're a Democrat.
Right.
And so the way to contrast that would be to look at what, do you have Republican numbers for 2024?
Yeah, it's 2024 looks like about, 85%. So you're up 7 points.
See, only 15% were sort of shying away from being proud of the country because Biden was the president. Whereas you're getting a lot. I mean, there's just so much partisanship on that issue on the Democratic side. But it's a bad thing for the country. And but you can see that pride in the country is a big part of what's led to a huge surge in volunteers for the U.S. military. They were going way down. Why would you want to volunteer for the military if the people who are leading the country don't inspire pride in the country?
With over three decades of serving up streetwise insight and local perspective on Page Two, the voice of John Cass has a home at johncassnews.com.
There's a new sheriff in town.
This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have.
But as he settles in, can you deal with the hysteria, the meltdowns, the constant whining?
I don't know what to do.
You know what you need? You need a good cup of common sense.
It's just common sense.
Like the kind of common sense you get when you subscribe to johncassnews.com. I'm John Cass, 40 years a journalist in Chicago.
That's the Chicago way.
I opened this website, John Cass News, so that you could have a decent cup of common sense.
This great country of ours was built on its entrepreneurial spirit.
It's time that you join the frontier of independent journalism at johncassnews.com.
Subscribe today to get access to great columns from John Cass, Dan Proft, and others. Don't be a chum alone and subscribe at johncassnews.com.
As we close, Charles, I want to get what you said earlier to elaborate on the census and whether or not they should be counting illegals and other non-citizens for the purposes of redistribution of congressional seats.
Well, the issue with the census is that there's a difference between what seems sensible and what you can do within the limits of our Constitution. And what seems sensible is that the members of Congress ought to be apportioned according to the number of U.S. citizens in each state and therefore in each district, right? We don't, if 10 million people all of a sudden showed up in San Francisco from China and weren't citizens, then you wouldn't say, well, San Francisco gets a lot more seats in Congress than other states. But our Constitution never anticipated that. And the way that that apportionment, that the census is supposed to count whole persons residing in each state. Well, you're a whole person and I'm a whole person, but I would still be a whole person if I had come into the country illegally and was not a citizen. I wouldn't be a whole person for these purposes if I were just visiting from France or England. But, and originally, this is what everybody in the audience remembers, that famous, infamous three-fifths. You would count slaves not as whole persons, one for one, but as three-fifths of a person. And that would give the slave-owning states, the states where there were slave owners, more representation than they would otherwise have by counting a portion of the slaves. But it wouldn't give them all the full number of slaves, so three-fifths.
Yes.
That was abolished after the Civil War. But it is now the case that the census counts whole persons and apportionment is according to census count, which occurs every 10 years. Trump has done two things with respect to citizenship, aside from closing the southern border, which has been just remarkably successful.
Yes.
What he said is, one thing is birthright citizenship, which currently, even if my wife and I came into the country illegally, we're not here legally, but we have a child in Chicago, that child is a legal U.S. citizen.
Anchor baby.
The baby is an anchor baby. Whether it anchors and allows my wife and me to then get citizenship is a different matter. But the baby would be a citizen. Now, Trump has issued an order saying, no, that's not so. And then the Supreme Court will ultimately have to rule on that. What they ruled on in the last term was that some technical aspects of that law couldn't be decided by a lower court. That this will ultimately have to go up to the Supreme Court and will probably be decided next year. And the legal experts think that birthright citizenship will remain after the court decides. But that, again, is a matter of constitutional interpretation. But the other issue is whether or not by a presidential decree or even by a law, if you could get it through the Senate, could say, no, apportionment will only be U.S. citizens. And the problem is that the Constitution doesn't contemplate the issue at all and simply says a census by the count of whole citizens and apportionment by the census count. And it looks like a president or even a law can't change that.
So it would seem that then this is going to be, you know, a lost cause. I mean,
yes,
go ahead.
The fact that Trump's policies aren't just preventing more illegal from coming in, but right. is leading to a lot of voluntary exits by people who are here illegally may well change the census count in 2030. But I also think it will save New York and California and maybe Texas and others a lot of money at the state level,
right.
because we're paying, and cities like Chicago and New York are paying billions to educate and all the rest. And Trump is giving them a huge assist, even if they say they don't want it, for their budgets by helping get rid of these people. The problem politically for Trump is that there's a lot of support for getting rid of people who've committed crimes, but there's not a lot of support for getting rid of people who are just living here, even though they came here illegally. And Trump himself now recognizes that that's a problem for farmers and some other industries. So he's trying to figure out how to get a workaround.
Well, and what about John Cass? Because John Cass states expressly that if we're counting people who are not citizens, you're giving more political power to the blue states that are sanctuary city states in violation. I would say Confederate states, because they're opposed. They're like the opposed to federal law, and they're giving power, more power that is fair to the blue state Confederate groups, and not to the people of the country that
You're right, but there may not be a way to get around that within the language of the Constitution. And none of us want to see the Constitution kind of arbitrarily breached.
Right.
I shouldn't say none of us. We have all kinds of people who say that the ends justify the means, yeah. but I'm not one of them.
And so it sounds like the only solution in Trump's mind and in the John Cass's world, and not that I'm saying it's not true, but I'm just playing devil's advocate here, is that there's going to have to be a sustained, prolonged effort to remove people who are here illegally to make those means happen or those ends happen because it's there's no other way, right? I mean, so is there a stopgap in front of that? I mean, do we build a better border? I mean, there's all these ideas to try to change that power swing, but we really can't. I mean, that's with the recipe's already been made.
Well, the fact that you're getting a lot of voluntary out-migration from people right. who were here illegally. And that's not only because of it's because in part of the ICE raids, but the ICE raids that are occurring on businesses discourage somebody from going to work illegally at business X or Y. If they think business X might be raided, they don't want to go to work there. And also the new law, the Big Beautiful Bill, mm-hmm. which prohibits a lot of federal funding from going to illegal immigrants, will make it harder for them to get medical care and a lot of other things. So you've reduced the incentives to stay here. And that's not just going to have an effect on people wanting to get across the border, but it's going to have an effect on people who are here, maybe wanting to go back to home country. So we don't know the effect, but there is a real problem here, and the problem really, and I still think it's kind of inexplicable why the Biden administration threw open the southern border. I mean, it was such bad policy, and it had such
fault, one word,
which is
replacement.
Oh boy,
I know that idea has been discredited, but I can't see any other rational reason for what they did. I mean, it was insanity.
I think the aside there is that you already nailed it, John, is that the idea is that they're going to build up all these sanctuary places are going to be the havens for these people, and then therefore it boosts their sliding population numbers, which we've seen it across the board in Illinois and a lot of liberal right. states. And so it helps them stave that outflow and then keeps right. them as contenders in Congress. I mean, I think that's really ultimately the calculus. That's
exactly right, Jeff. And I think there was one more calculation, which turned out to be a serious miscalculation. They thought that the major ethnic group that's in play electorally are Hispanics, and Republicans are making giant inroads in the Hispanic yeah. population. As they vote, and especially as they become second and third generation and work their way up the mm-hmm. American skills ladder and job ladder and so forth. I think that Democrats thought that Hispanics would favor these open borders and more Hispanics coming in.
But they turned out
they didn't. That was a terrible miscalculation. Right.
It just increases competition for the scarce resources that might be available, and it's
right. That also played out in the black community, but it also increased crime in Hispanic communities because it let in these criminal gangs from Mexico and Venezuela and Central America that were importing drugs and sex slaves and all the rest.
Right.
And so there's been a huge pushback against that. So I think that the electoral group that's the most in play going forward are Hispanics, and you're going to see that in the next elections.
I would just like to say one thing. Gentlemen, Jeff and Charles Lipson, thank you for helping me write another column. I love you guys. For Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, the Ritzma Chair, University of Chicago. You can see his writing at charleslipson.com. And for Jeff Carlin, future physics teacher, what do they say at the Sicilian block party, Jeff? Friends to cats, baker of pies.
Yes. I have to put that on my business card now, thanks to you.
That's it. And for me, John Cass, editor of johncassnews.com, we always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. $50 a year. Join us, won't you? and join us again on the Chicago Way on WGN+.